Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. It is Christmas Eve, December 25th, 2014. This is my last show of the year, including covering a couple of recent topics. Basically, I want to kind of put the world aside, all of the calamity, the insanity, which we all understand that much of this is coming from man-made sources, intentional. I want to set much of the world aside to talk about Christmas topics. It is something we should do at least once a year, set everything else aside. But it includes all of the voluminous amount of activity that's going on around us. So I call this Christmas presentation the Seven C's of Christmas. Seven, a nice prime number. It's been used many times in the past for everything from the seven dwarfs to the seven sister stars in the sky. At any rate, this evening's talk, I'll be talking about the seven C's of Christmas. And these are my own seven C's. And first, I want to prelude this conversation with a little discussion of how Christmas is so distorted. I'm sure we've seen all of the everything from football to every form of distorted Christmas story to make us feel good, the people that's monster that stole Christmas or whatever it is. You know, anything but referring to the one real reason for Christmas. Isn't it funny they still even call it Christmas? But Christmas refers to a Christian holiday, the birth of Christ. And that's the first C, is Christ and Christmas. I'll be talking about the Christmas star in a minute, but it's a story that has remained for thousands of years, and there's a reason for this. It's a very powerful story. The entire point of Christmas is celebrating the beginning of the life of Christ, which we really don't know a lot about in the early years. But what we can fill in some details is that he spent a bit of time with a guy named Joseph of Arimathea, along with his own father, who was a carpenter named Joseph. But Christ had a very good education, let's just put it that way. Apart from all other aspects of his existence, he had a very good education, and I'll be talking a little bit. One of the C's refers to textbooks that came down from the library of Joseph of Arimathea. So, first of all, you have to look at the person's life, and most of us, you hear what somebody might say, oh, I'm this or I'm that, but as human beings, what we actually do is we look at what people do, whether they're politicians or pastors or people or friends or relatives or spouses or children. We've learned as people, don't believe what somebody says, look at what they do. And that's why a lot of people keep their life hidden, because they've learned how to con by pretending to be something they're not. Politicians are wonderful for that. A good politician is one that speaks with a forked tongue, that can sell you a bill of goods, and it's a complete lie, telling you it's for your benefit. But there's an event, and it's one event that I consider a major event. I'll refer to a couple of events in Christ's life. It's throwing the money changers out of the temple. Now, this is an interesting event, because a lot of times Christ is referred to as a pacifist personality, someone who talks about peace. But on this particular day, the money changers, we all know who they were in the temple doing their thing. And he says, no, no, no. And he talked about a guy that got violent. He's throwing these people and their tables and their money and everything out into the street. Okay, so that should give us a lesson in life. We have a problem, the biggest problem in all of our lives as modern day people, especially as Christians, who people who just want to live and enjoy life and respect their family members, etc. We have a big problem because while you're sleeping, there are people plotting to steal everything you have. And you have a right. Don't think about being a pacifist when it comes to this. Throw those people out. Physically throw them out. And so that's one thing that I wanted to talk about. Another was the end days. And I'll be talking about some of the other C's. About all of the other C's have to do with something we call the end days, the days in which the days of society are numbered, where things are happening. And lo and behold, what is the description? When we look at all of the texts that are available, and let's look at Christ's own description. There's a sermon he gives, and he's talking to the people, and somebody raises their hands and says, "Hey, you know, we're just regular people here. How are we going to know?" You're talking about people being sent to fool us. These are educated people. How are we going to know what's the truth and not? Because, as you say, these people are con men, professional liars, educated. And how are we going to know what's the truth? And the very simple answer is, you will know the truth because it's written in your heart. In other words, everybody's born with a baloney meter, or a BS meter built right in. When you hear the BS, you know it. And so that's why politicians are having a difficult time with the public now. We have the internet, we have the ability to communicate. I have this radio show, not just a small classroom in a university someplace. I'm able to communicate, but back to the original point. The end day prophecies was the result of a question. Somebody said, when all of this takes place and the end days come, how are we going to know that? And first of all, one of the answers was that many false prophets will be sent out to lead you astray. And I mean, I can't imagine of a time in history more ripe with liars than today. The news media, the court system, the government, the newspapers, the internet controlled by the government, I mean the Google, Wikipedia, every place you turn, television shows, television specials, all the diversions thrown in front of people, the monetary system, the evening news. All of it designed to keep you at bay, to make you think that the 40-hour-a-week employment record is the biggest statistic on the planet. That's one of the signs that this is, you know, just rampant, the number of people being sent to lead you astray in science. The scientists who are out there leading the public astray because their paycheck depends on it. They got a PhD in complete misinformation, and they're going to guard that because that paycheck and that retirement and their family and the kids going to college and their respect with their peers, on and on. Science today is the most distorted field in the world, and there's nothing more distorted than the world of astronomy, space science, space physics, if you want to call it. And just a side note there, you have to understand, I have personally a very good background in physics. I have studied in the university system, I've taught in the university system, and I've learned myself outside the university system. And what I've come to learn is that the people in the university systems are cloistered. They're people that have no knowledge of what's really going on in the world today. Just take cometary science. Right now, the European Space Agency scientists are over there looking at the Rosetta mission and have no clue of what they're looking at. I talked about that on last week's show. They have a lander sitting on the surface of a comet, and it's not doing what they anticipated. They are taking measurements with an orbiter that's orbiting a comet nucleus, and they don't understand what the relationship is between the data from the nucleus, which is not showing them organic molecules or water or ice, any form of water or heavy water. They're not detecting any of that on the nucleus. So what are they doing? They're hiding the data and then taking measurements up in the top of the atmosphere, 100 kilometers away from the comet nucleus, and then saying, oh, well, that's from the comet nucleus. Well, they have a lander immediately on the nucleus that's not detecting any of this. And by the way, I just wanted to give this one little scientific fact. Following up from last week's show, and 2 weeks ago, where I announced that the Rosetta mission scientists had released data stating that they had detected water coming off the comet nucleus, and I pointed out that that was not coming off the comet nucleus. The water they detected, and I confirmed this is the point I want to make, I got an email from the head of the European Space Agency, myself, personal email, stating that they detected the heavy water that I talked about, the deuterium water, the heavy water, and the regular water, and the ratio that they measured was 10 kilometers above the surface of the comet nucleus, and 100 kilometers above the surface of the nucleus. So I was exactly correct in telling you that was what I already knew, but I got a confirmation, as I said, from the head of the European Space Agency group and dealing with that, the cometary measurements, confirming that they did not detect water on the nucleus. The articles that were put out talked about that, but the actual measurements were from the orbiter orbiting the comet nucleus, and the measurements were made 10 and 100 kilometers above the nucleus, not at the nucleus, because why would you take a measurement at the nucleus? Because there ain't nothing there. And just a physics note here, if you would imagine a comet that if it were made of ice and snow and that water were coming off to fill the tail area, then all of that material that fills the tail area would have to be concentrated coming off the nucleus from all sides in a very even distribution, not some little jet that occurs every few weeks or something. And so none of that is happening, and they're not seeing it. So all they're doing is taking measurements up in the tail area, and they're sitting there scratching their nose or whatever they scratch, and they can't figure out where the water is coming from in the tail, because it ain't coming from the nucleus. And they don't know what to say. They're sitting there like lockjaw. They can't say anything. So at any rate, I don't want to concentrate on that, but I want to, this show is so important. One of the C's, the next C I'm going to talk about is comets. Well, what do comets have to do with Christmas? They have a lot, because my point is, reverting back to the end days, when they finally get to the point when Christ talks about the end days and what to see, he says, first of all, you will have a barrage of misinformation coming at you. There will be experts sent out to lead you astray. And then you look up in the heavens and you will see the signs in the heavens. You will see that the moon will appear to turn to blood. The stars will seem to fall from the heavens. Then he talks about the fire and the naphtha. And basically the hydrocarbons coming out of the sky, that there will be just like in the old days. And this is when you refer back to the Old Testaments, and this is what I was saying. Christ was very well educated in the old, all of the old references to what happened in the ancient days, in the days of Moses, in the days of Noah, when the great flood occurred. And so when he talks about this, he doesn't say, look up for a comet. He says, look for the signs in the heavens. And this was, in a sense, a metaphor, a figuristic description, because they were simple people. You know, you couldn't say, well, it's a comet. But what he also knew that in the end days, the whole story of what comets were would be distorted. And so the description was of the effects of a comet, the stars seeming to fall from the sky. That's the meteor stream that associated with comets. The moon turning to blood, and I've talked about this before, when the sulfur, a big comet is going to reach all the way out to the region of Jupiter and pull in that sulfur from the region around Jupiter, and that sulfur dioxide is a reddish orange. So looking at the moon through that dust is going to give you the appearance of a red moon. Also, there's descriptions in the ancient text about when large comets come by, they affect the moon, and the moon erupts with lava flows. So you see this red, the moon turns to red blood, like dribbling across the face of the moon. And so all of these effects causing the moon to turn red. So at any rate, what he's describing are celestial events caused by a large comet. And so that brings me into my second topic, dealing with comets. The first thing you can say about comets is there's just an enormous amount of misinformation about comets. The whole issue of comets in the ancient text is very clear. The comets are not dirty snowballs. There's so much effort put on that in the news media by scientists that work for the space agencies and the universities, and all the way, you have to understand education the way it works. Education is something I've been involved with about half of my career. I've taught at the university level. I taught for 1 year out of my college in Mexico. I went to Mexico and I taught the very rich students there, of the very wealthy. I taught math and science to those students, and that was for 1 year. Then I came back and got my advanced degree. Then I began teaching in a university in foreign countries, and I taught physics and mathematics, every level of mathematics, computer science. And then when I came back to the U.S., I taught astronomy at the university level. I taught calculus. I taught various other topics. And so mathematics is something I know something about. Also, I know something about the educational system. And when I was at Cornell, 1979 to 81, I got a very good glimpse of top-down education. Here is how it works. At the university level, a big university like Cornell, the astronomy department politically ruled the roost. The most famous person in the world in science at that time was Carl Sagan, who ran the astronomy department. He didn't run the astronomy department, but he was the big name, and that's what brought in the money. And of course, and if you're in a university setting, that's what counts. He was given the Cosmos Series special. The point is that all of the other departments had to step in line. The geology department, the biology department, there was a new department that had just formed, archaeoastronomy department. All of these departments had to follow the marching call of the astronomy department, with Carl Sagan, who was, like I say, had the Cosmos Series at the time. For 2 years he was in Los Angeles, so he really wasn't there when I was there, but still that power, that all science had to follow the lead of the astronomy department. And so here I am in the middle of that group, that science group there in the physics department, astrophysics, space science, and astronomy, those four fields, telling these people that basically everything they're doing is wrong, and using the data that's coming in to tell them this. So but the point I'm making about education is that what they had to teach came from the astronomy department on down. So they had to teach the fact that, or the concept that the Earth did all of these things by itself, that there was no great flood, that there was no comet Venus that came through the solar system. A little known fact is that Carl Sagan made his fortune and fame because he was the one who led the fight, the scientific fight, against Velikovsky. I've talked about this before on my show, and there's a tremendous amount of literature and the history of this whole story about Velikovsky talking about comets, Venus the comet, coming through the solar system, ravaging Mars, removing the atmosphere of Mars, etc., and then coming by Earth on two occasions, and then settling in and becoming the planet Venus. And of course, none of this made any sense at all scientifically until I came along at Cornell. I had been out of the country for 10 years, and I had finally came back to the U.S. I didn't know who Velikovsky was. I didn't know about the Velikovsky controversy or that what Carl Sagan at Cornell had done. And here I end up in the faculty of Cornell University doing my research, showing that comets are not dirty snowballs, but they're a plasma discharge of the solar capacitor, doing all of my work, the induced electric dipole redshift, which shows that the Big Bang never happened and shows that the redshift in stars is due to a physical electrical phenomena regarding the electrical conditions around galaxies and quasars, etc., etc. And so the point I'm making is that when science has locked into this dirty snowball comet model concept, it's very important for the world leaders, and this is a topic I talk about in my book, The Diamond Principle, it's very important for the world leaders to lock in on that, because the whole concept of comets, not only would the public find out that they can get energy for free from the ionosphere, this is what Tesla was doing, but more importantly, it would relate to all of the ancient history, the founding, the most fundamental aspects or events in the development of the human race, the Noah's flood, the Moses event, which was the passage of the big comet Venus before it became the planet Venus, the Noah event being a completely different comet, the 40 days and 40 nights of flood where the Earth passed through a comet tail. The correct knowledge of what a comet was would not only set the past in perspective, would not only set Christ into perspective, but it would also point to the future, in that someday one of these large rogue planets, something we call Planet X in the modern society, but that story has been distorted beyond all belief. Crazy ladies talking to aliens, on and on and on. But the true story is that Planet X would be a large comet, and there are many, many, many of them. Not just one called Nibiru. Nibiru is a specific one of which we have extremely small amount of information. And there's a lot of people out there trying to misquote me and blend me in with all kinds of other people who have commented on that topic. But the end result is Planet X is a comet. And that's what in the end days prophets they're talking about. They're talking about comets. Christ is talking about that. If you look at any of the other major prophecies that come out of that same set of ancient history books, that's what they're doing. They're describing what happened before, and that's going to happen in the future again. And one of the comments is, when is this going to happen? And one of the answers is, there will be a lot of false prophets that come to give you false dates. And this is something that happens constantly. You got people out there on the internet or on radio shows, Planet X is here. We've photographed it from some crater in Central America. You know, just complete garbage out there constantly, and that's one of the biggest ploys of the government misinformation programs, is to talk about, say, Planet X being here, but it's false information. The crying wolf regarding Planet X, always trying to make it into a crazy topic so people turn away from it. So misinformation, good grief, you've got it beyond all possible normal expectations. So I've gotten first through the first two C's, Christ and Christmas, of course, and the second C, comets. Okay, the third C I want to talk about is catastrophes and crisis. And there's certainly no other time in history when we've experienced crises much like today. History has been filled with crises. There's basically, I would divide them into two categories, created by man and natural. And there's the type that are created by man, which are designed to look like natural events, the tsunami in Japan, and the nuclear disaster there was a man-made event. The nuclear reactor at Fukushima was blown up. There's no question about that. It was not caused by a tsunami or an earthquake. That's absolutely ridiculous. So man-made events, some of the man-made events are done through ignorance, and some of them done by psychopathic leaders. I'm not going to go down that path and talk about all of the events recent and in the past that have happened. But basically, there's no guarantee that the universe we live in is going to be a nice, tranquil place. And that's one of the things that astronomy tries to portray. Oh, don't worry about it. It happened billions of years ago or billions of light years away, and it couldn't happen here. Why do they do that? Because they want to keep the public tranquil. If they told you the truth, and the Vatican is one of the worst places in the world dealing with this, they have hired astronomers that are manning observatories. They started in Arizona, then they went to South America, then they went to Antarctica to produce even bigger telescopes. What are they looking for? They're looking for Planet X. Something that you're not supposed to believe in. And all of these other crazy people out there claiming they see Planet X, this is all part of misinformation. And so why doesn't the Vatican publicly admit what it's doing? Searching for rogue planets in the form of comets. And this is something I have from my own inside information, that the telescopes that they have are not deep sky telescopes. They are cometary telescopes. They are specifically designed to look for comets. You don't need big telescopes to look for comets. You need search engines. You need programmed searches of the night sky and where they're looking. The reason they have the telescopes at the South Pole, because in the South Polar winter, you get an observational view of the night sky, which you cannot see from basically any other point on Earth. And so that's the best place to see that remote portion of the southern sky. You can also see it from other parts of the South America, deep in South America. But notice that there are no major astronomical facilities in the Northern Hemisphere. They're concentrating down there because that's where they're expecting it to come from, or they're already observing something. And understand that these things move very, very, very slowly until they start picking up speed as they come into the solar system. Then they start picking up speed. That's the way elliptical orbits work. But back to the point, the universe is a very dangerous place to be. Through natural events, it's an even more dangerous place once you give power over to a bunch of psychopathic maniacs like we have today. So not only is there misinformation being put out in volumes and volumes, but the real information is not being put out at all. So what a strange situation, but if you wanted to look at the end day prophecies, and I'm not saying that we're necessarily in the end days, I'm just saying that, look, buddy, if ever there were a time that were ripe, it's certainly now. So my first three C's, Christ and Christmas, that's actually two, but I'm counting them as one, comets, and catastrophes. Well, catastrophes, the real catastrophes that you have to worry about are not the stock market crash or other things. And by the way, I'll be talking in a minute about other C's about, that would refer to preparation. But the biggest catastrophe events in the world, in the universe, that you have to be particularly disturbed about are comets. And so that's why they want you to think that comets are little fluffy snowballs, just couldn't do anything, just little teeny snowballs. But they land on a comet nucleus, it's a hot, dry rock, there's nothing coming off of it. You can see the big tail up there, they're right there, they see the tail over there, and they're looking at the nucleus, nothing's coming off the nucleus. We've been to how many comets now? Half a dozen? Not a single comet nucleus has ever shown vapor coming off to form the tail. And it would have to look like a steam engine coming out all directions to make that nice symmetric tail. So the fact that when they first got to the first comet, the news media kind of went mum for about a year. You didn't quite hear that dirty snowball conversation at all. And all of a sudden it started again. And from then on, everything was a fluffy little wanderer from outer space, the Oort cloud, which is a hypothesis region where comets supposedly form. All of this phony, baloney, made-up fairy tale science pawned off on the public to keep you thinking that comets are dirty snowballs. Why? Because the main thing you should be looking at, and this comes right back to Christmas, because let's go back to the very first issue dealing with Christmas. Even before Christmas, even before the birth of Christ, you have the three kings. Not one, not two, but three. The three kings. The three kings, the Magi as they're called, bringing gifts from various foreign countries. And what did they see? They saw a star. There's stars all over the sky. What was so special about this star? It had a tail. And the tail directed them where they should go. They discovered it in the east, but they lived in the east. And it said the story is that they followed it to the west. Well, how does that happen? How does a star that they discovered in the east lead them to the west? Well, that's because there's a very well-known fact of comets. Once they round the sun, then they change from the evening. If they're in the east, they're in the morning sky. If they're crossed the plane of the sun and gone behind the sun and come out the other side, now they're in the evening sky in the west. Okay, so this star was there for a long period of time, years. Once again, there's a huge amount of misinformation trying to tell you that the Christmas star was a triple alliance of planets. But planetary alignments only last for a couple hours, and they happen all the time. So there's nothing unusual. What was so special about some planetary alignment? And they say, oh, well, there was one of Jupiter and Venus or something thousands of years ago. No, planetary alignments happen, and they last for actually a matter of hours. And then the alignment goes away. Earth moves on in its orbit. The alignment is no longer valid. You need something that was up there for probably a year, a comet. But not just any comet. We have comets all the time. What was so special about this comet that these three kings in various countries knew what it was when they came and talked? They passed through the country where Herod was. They knew, everybody knew, hey, this is the star. You see that star? That's the one that everybody's been waiting for. There was something very special about that star. Could it have been a companion? Yes, it could have been a companion. Probably not one companion, but two companions. In other words, something orbiting the main comet nucleus. if there's a little comet nucleus, fluffy little snowball, then there's not going to be anything major visible orbiting this. So once again, there you come back to something big, a big comet, big nucleus, with a couple things orbiting in a very set pattern that these guys, these kings, were looking for. When they saw it, they knew. They saw it in the east, but they followed it to the west, the Christmas star. Now, I've given many talks on this. A number of years ago, I gave a series of conferences and then a radio show hosted by my good friend Brad Walton, now deceased. Brad and I arranged to have a special, and it was the Christmas star special. The day after that special, there were 33,000 new postings on the internet claiming that the Christmas star was anything but a comet. A combination of planets, a triple alignment, some explosion of a star exploding, a nova, everything under the sun. Except nobody wanted to talk about it being a comet. Why? Because that's exactly what it was. And there again, you have the churches who should be all over this topic not talking about it at all. And there again, that's that good old 503c status, the tax status the churches get where they can't talk about certain topics. And so they fluff this over. And unfortunately, the real issues of Christmas, the fact that that Christ came and his signal of him coming was a very special comet. So the end days, comets. The very beginning of Christ's life, comets. And here we find today that the most important topic in our life that we should be looking for and planning for, and as a society getting off of this planet, having multiple thousands and hundreds of thousands of people going into outer space, we have nothing. We have a space program that's a smokescreen. It's called NASA, same as the European Space Agency in Europe, but that couldn't put a mouse into space. And there's no hope for the people on this planet to get into space. A number of weeks ago, I reported on private space programs being blown up on the launch pad. Gee, is there somebody who doesn't really want you going into outer space, fulfilling your birthright to the stars? Is that possible? Yes, it is. Because that would allow the public freedom from the slave ship that's become planet Earth. Next C I want to talk about, calendars. Calendars are very important. We have lunar calendars, we have solar calendars, we have calendars based on atomic frequencies. There's all types of calendars. I particularly have developed myself what I call the Recalendar Emergency Sun-Star Clock. It's basically a plate that has a solar calendar and all the information to determine a calendar and basically a sun watch, a sun clock, all in one. It works any place on Earth, North or South Hemisphere, and it's been very popular over the years. I don't really know how long that thing has been out there and selling to the public, but there's nothing else like it on the planet. Ancient mariners would have loved to have that device. Very simple. It's under $50, including shipping. This is not an advertisement. I'm just saying that calendars are very important. The point of calendars is back in the ancient days after the planet Venus formed, after the comet Venus came by and wrenched Earth out of its orbit and changed the rotational aspect of Earth in its orbit. People wrestled for hundreds of years trying to rebuild the calendar. Prior to that, the Earth had 360-day year. Afterwards, it was 365 days. And this is well known. In fact, this is what Velikovsky was doing. just make a quick point about Veliskovsky. What he was doing was not talking about science or comets or Venus becoming a planet. What he was saying was he was simply identifying an event in ancient history, which was the Venus event, the Moses event, where the comet came by, affected Earth on two different occasions, and about 54 years apart. The Mayan talk about it, the ancient Chinese, Tibetans, the history of other ancient cultures, all of this describing the same event. That and I talk about this on my, I have a two CD set, The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters, where I talk about, it's an 18 hours of lectures where I talk about ancient celestial disasters. And so, once again, this comes back to the topic of calendars. If a catastrophe happens, whether it's man-made, whether it's celestial, whether it's a physical event, and one of the first thing that people are going to lose is calendars and time. They're going to lose track of it in a couple days. Most people depend on a watch, they depend on a computer, they depend on a radio program where they can flip on the TV, get the time and the date, etc. They work a five-day-a-week job, and so that keeps them tuned to the calendar, what day of the week it is. But without that, you would lose track of the calendar almost immediately. And so one of the issues with calendars is that when you have catastrophes, when you have other events happen, or if you have a scenario where a comet comes by Earth, sends everybody back into the cave ages, the first thing you're going to need besides a glass of clean water is a calendar. What season is it? The device I built also allows you to rebuild the calendar. No matter whether, does not matter what happened to Earth, if it changed from had a pole shift or whatever, you can find the new and determine the new calendar. That's one thing that Veliskovsky made very clear. And one thing we do not know, what was Earth's old orbit? We don't know. There's no information. The calendar that I have has all the information so that in the future, if in 10,000 years after a major pole shift, this device were dug up, they'd say, oh, okay, here was the year, here was the time of these events back in the history of man, but here was the orbit of Earth. And it has all of the information there to determine that. It's an amazing little device on a single plate that is almost indestructible, unless you drive over it with a tank. The imprinting, etc., is all very permanent. But the important point is that calendars and time, the keeping track of time based on the solar calendar. And by the way, the lunar calendar is very difficult to use or to follow. The moon does not really give us a very stable calendar because the repetitional cycles are very varied. They don't follow the nice annual cycle as with the sun. And so basically the sun is used for the primary calendar. You have all kinds of religions, ancient mythologies, etc., that use the moon for calendars. There are many religious events that are based on the calendar. The Christian calendar is full of lunar events and lunar time scales, but it doesn't always correspond neatly. It changes, it varies with the solar calendar, and that's because the moon and the sun are totally separate bodies. The moon orbits Earth on a very distinct orbit at an angle, and the sun, we revolve around the sun in a slightly elliptical orbit. So the true calendar of Earth is the solar calendar, and that's locked with the stars also. So the sun-star clock also has a wheel which allows you to determine the calendar and time based on the night star system. And so the whole issue of Christmas, the catastrophes of comets, and calendars. Calendar is a very important C And of course, the Christian calendar has dates set up that are very specific relative to major events, primarily in the life of Christ, and then some of the Old Testament also. But if you look at the Old Testament, it's simply a history book of catastrophes and the lineage of people that came down after each catastrophe from one event to the other, starting out with the Genesis, with the Noah event, thousands of years later the Moses event, thousands of years later again the birth of Christ, and then thousands of years later modern life as we see it today. Calendars. Okay, so we're through four C's so far. Christ and Christmas, comets, catastrophes and crises. Calendars, number five, I actually have two C's here, is calm and confidence. Okay, so given the fact that we live in a somewhat unruly universe, run by people who are even more unruly, calm and confidence is a very important topic. The evening news wants you to be upset, distraught. Everything is, when you get done watching the evening news, they want you to be very upset that everything is in topsy-turvy condition. And then the other implication is that, gee, our good people in government are watching after you, and they're going to try their darndest to fix all of this. When the reality is that everything that's wrong with what's going on today is caused by the government, and that's a very blanket statement. You would live if, for example, the states really ran their own lives and the lives of their people without sending all of the money to the federal government, where it just gets buried and wasted in a huge bureaucracy. You would have tons of money left over, and you could support your senior citizens, you could support Social Security, Medicare, everything else. The problem is that most of the money that goes to Washington is wasted in the bureaucracy, and very little comes back to the people that gave it. So the whole issue of evening news is to keep you upset. The stock market, the jobless rate, the housing crisis, the war in the Mideast, the terrorists, the next boogeyman terrorist that the CIA decides to trump up, on and on and on. It's a method of control. You know, there's the old Maxwell Smart TV show where the enemy was called chaos, and basically that's the situation that exists today, chaos. Well, just the whole world is topsy-turvy, upside down, and nuts. And it's by plan, because, you know, back when I was a kid, it was like illegal to talk to anybody from Russia. They didn't want you talking to anybody from Russia. They had the official people, only those official people could talk to the official people in Russia. You couldn't get to talk to somebody from Russia unless it were on a battlefield, and that was with a gun in your hand. And so that was the only conversation you were going to have with a guy from Russia or Cuba or whatever other country was out there. And so the Cold War with Russia, the chaos that was spawned from that created event that the bankers created, lasted for 50 years. They were able to control the United States, reap untold amount of taxes, Reagan's Star War, etc., which people don't know we're still paying for, just the interest on Reagan's Star Wars, breaking this country down, providing untold amount of debt, and strapping the people here to that debt. Okay, so at any rate, like I say, whether it's the housing crisis, the bank bailout, I mean, you name it, these situations are created. There are teams of people that work in think tanks, and that's what they do. They create a mess. And the whole point is that then you need the government to come and protect you. It's the old protection racket where you see on TV, you know, a guy down the street in the big city, he's got his a meat shop or a tailor shop or whatever it is. The boys come in, say, hey, you know, you need some protection here, buddy. And the guy goes, well, you know, I haven't had any problems. Nobody's ever bothered me. All the neighborhood is great. And they go, well, you know, if you don't buy our protection, you might have some problems. And the guy goes, well, you know, I really don't need your protection. I don't have any problems. Comes back the next day to his shop. It's all busted up, destroyed. And then they come back, and the guys come back, the boys come back, and they go, well, you know, if you had our protection, none of this would have happened. That's the protection racket, and that's what's going on in Washington, D.C. That's what the bankers live by. The bankers, the politicians in Washington are just middle management in a worldwide banking scheme, and that's what they do. They rule by deception and chaos. And the only reaction that the citizenry can have is calm and confidence. Because if you can live, like I've said before, the term I use is First Nation. You have to live your own First Nation. You have to live your own democracy. And I've gotten letters from people who've made the moves to be water independent, to be food independent, to continue to live if all the facilities, the infrastructure shuts down. And then they, when they hit that point, they become very happy because they know they can live without the, you know, when the evening news comes on and talks about the jobless rate, it doesn't affect them. I had a friend of mine talk about his grandpa. His grandpa had a farm down in Texas. And so he was at the farm and the grandpa was out there working and making some stuff and fixing stuff on the farm. And he goes, Grandpa, what did you do in the Great Depression? And the grandpa goes, I heard there was one. The point is that the Great Depression didn't affect him. He worked on his ranch. He had everything he needed. He didn't need anything from town. All the food he ate came from the ranch. All of the everything he needed, the fence posts, whatever he needed, came from the ranch. And, of course, you know, whatever little bit of need he might have had, he really didn't need this. Society went on. The economy of society went on. The Great Depression went on. He didn't even know about it. Didn't affect him because he didn't depend on it. That's the point where you have to be in your life completely free and independent of that system. And if you get to that point, sure, you can have a job, work, have a nice house, do whatever you want. But have that instantaneous button you can push. All of a sudden, the family is on independence mode, and you're able to protect and keep what you have and live a life that's comfortable, not depend on the big, shiny government truck to come rolling down the road and dump off supplies, which ain't going to happen, by the way. Merry Christmas. So, anyway, calm and confidence. Two C's counting as one. And I remember something that a joke about this with some friends of mine who have later become in life antagonistic to the, let's say, the ruling regime. Let's put it that way. When I was a kid, I grew up as a Christian, as a Catholic, and they had this thing called confirmation. And in there, they basically said, you're going to run into people out there that are not going to, they're not going to like you. And this is something you have to be able to stand up. You have to stand on your own 2 feet. Now that you're becoming adults, you've been trained, you know what to do, you know what's right, what's wrong, etc. You got to stand on your feet, and you have to face the world. And sometimes it's the whole world and you. So better get used to it. And so part of that is giving you the confidence that you can stand on your own 2 feet. So when I stood in front of lecture halls full of angry astronomers trying to scream at me, telling me I'm, you know, that they're right and their PhDs are correct in astronomy and dirty snowball, whatever, I just look at them and tell them, you're wrong. You got a PhD in bullshit, mister. You don't know what you're doing. And they look at you, and the thing is, you tell them with confidence, you tell them with and you point out, not just tell them, and I don't rely on some kind of badge, government badge to stand behind. I just tell them and I show them why and show them with their data. And you know what? They don't have a leg to stand on and they know it. So they're hiding behind their badge, they're hiding behind their paycheck, they're hiding behind their government job, and getting to that retirement, and all they want to do is get to that retirement point where they can leave and not have to talk to anybody, and maybe go fishing or publish a few more papers, come back to their tenured office, but they really don't have anything, and they can't say anything, and they know that everything they've done in their lifetime is wrong. But you know what? You don't know how many thousands and tens of thousands of scientists do that? Because they get a paycheck. 99.9% of all science today is government funded in some aspect or another. The next C, Chaldeans. I want to refer to the Colburn, the Chaldeans who maintained those texts, the Library of Joseph of Arimathea, part of which was burned by the Romans back in the Middle Ages. Part of that library was retained, and then that became the Colburn, what is known as the Colburn today. You can still get a copy of that book, the Kolbrin. Do not buy the one on the internet, on Amazon. Buy the one from the Chaldean Trust in Australia. I think it's a bookstore in New Zealand who is selling it. Get that book and treasure it, read it. And that talks about the ancient catastrophes, the future of man, how to live. It's an amazing book. So the Chaldeans is C number six. The last C, number seven, I call coming. The coming ages, the coming time. When the future, that's another term that you could use, but the time that we're coming to right now. Are you ready? Are you prepared? Are you an independent person? Do you have what you need to be independent? And you go back to the life of Christ. He had one robe that he wore. That's all he owned. His sandals and his robe and his brain and his ability to speak. People didn't like that. People did not like that at all. He had some serious major league enemies. Throwing the money changers out of the temple did not enhance his status with certain people. If you look at who was screaming the loudest before the crucifixion, it was the money changers, because he was his lectures out in the countryside, the people were walking off their jobs, going out to listen to him. They were saying, hey, we don't have to work anymore. We can come out here. We get free food. This is a whole new eye-opening event. He was teaching them about their true history, on and on. So the future, where is this planet going? Where is the human race going? It's all wrapped together on this Christmas Day, December 25th, 2014. And I'm about out of time here, so I want to wish all of you a Merry Christmas. This is James McCanney. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.